if we actually have a democracy where every person's vote matters, then we need a court system that will protect that against the political actors who are trying to gain a political advantage by taking away people's right to vote or by trying to shape the electorate how they want, whether it's through gerrymandering, whether it's through cutbacks on voting opportunities, whether it's through voter ID laws that they know certain constituencies will have a harder time complying with.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. My guest today, Josh Douglas, is a law professor, a podcaster, and the author of several books on election law and voting rights, including a new one called The Court Versus the Voters, the troubling story of how the Supreme Court has undermined voting rights. I really enjoyed talking to him about his interesting career path, his work, and about the Supreme Court on voting rights and related matters over the past few decades. You should listen. So, after a quick word from my sponsor, my interview with Josh Douglas about the court and the voters.
This episode is brought to you by Graphicacy. Graphicacy is an analytic design firm that can help you advance the mission of your organization using your own real data and information. They are 21st century visual communicators who create interactive graphics, motion graphics, and data visualizations. You can find Graphicacy at graphicacy.com. That is GRAPHICACY.com. With Graphicacy's help, you can visualize a better world.
Josh, would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Yep. So I'm Josh Douglas. I am a law professor at the University of Kentucky, Rosenberg College of Law, focusing on election law and voting rights. My new book is titled The Court Versus the Voters, The Troubling Story of How the Supreme Court Has Undermined Voting Rights. I also wrote a book in 2019 called Vote for Us, How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting.
Can you tell me a little bit about where you grew up, your education, and how your path led you to this particular field of study and work?
Sure. So I was born in New York, but then moved to Massachusetts when I was 8, lived in Western Massachusetts all through high school. I think I always had an interest in civic engagement. I mean, I remember going to vote with my mom on election day. The precinct was at our school, and I remember it was in the gymnasium, and a lot of the other kids were upset that we didn't have gym class that day, but I was excited to accompany my mom as she went to vote. Then went to DC, attended George Washington University for undergrad and majored in political science. And I went to GW mostly because I was interested in politics and thought DC would be an exciting place to be. From there, after a couple of years off, I went to law school. And it was really in my second year of law school when I took a voting rights course with Professor Spencer Overton that I kind of saw a path for me because it was marrying my undergraduate experience and major in political science with my new legal education. And it was in that class that I got to write a scholarly article called A Student Note. And I went to my professor and asked him to help me with the topic. That's where I began to understand the power of scholarship and the ability of a law professor to help to effectuate change. You know, a lot of law professors do great work, but their fields are very arcane or specific, and it's much more theoretical. I've always thought it's important for someone like me who does voting rights and election law to ensure that my work is practical, that is accessible to everyone, not just legal scholars. And it was really the origins in that voting rights course that I think helped me to understand the path that I wanted to take.
What was the student note that you wrote about?
So it was titled A Vote for Clarity, And it was about a Supreme Court doctrine with respect to how to determine whether there's a burden on the right to vote. So the Supreme Court has this line of cases referred to as Anderson Burdick often. These two cases, Anderson versus Celebrezze and Burdick versus Takushi, cases that are a little bit arcane with respect to voting rights. But what the court has said in those cases is that it's only going to give very close scrutiny, only going to look very carefully for a state's justification for a voting law if the law imposes a severe burden on voters. But the court has never defined what it means to impose a severe burden, for when a state law imposes a severe burden on voters. So my student note suggested a test that the court should adopt for what it means to be a severe burden, and therefore for the court to more carefully scrutinize a state law. I haven't read it in years, so who knows if I think it's any good today, but that's what it was.
And severe burden seems like a pretty high bar. It feels like it should be like a fairly modest burden is not a very good idea when you've spread it out over a population and it affects people in different ways.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, what the court has said basically is that, look, states need to be able to run elections. They don't want the courts having to micromanage every aspect of a state's administration of an election. And so I agree that it is too high of a bar. So again, my student note was sort of trying to suggest a test that would make sense, that would let the court invoke that standard more often. Because you're right, what has happened is that the court almost always finds that a law does not impose a severe burden. So therefore, defers to states in how they run their elections. So yeah, in practice, the test is not invoked, I think, often enough.
I thought I saw you were a White House intern during your time there in D.C.
I was, yeah. In 99 and 2000. So this is the end of the Clinton years. And it was a fascinating experience. I was assigned to the White House Advance Office. So this is the office that plans all presidential trips off of White House grounds. And I even got to go on a trip. And again, I was just in college, but the president was speaking in Philadelphia, two events on one day in Philadelphia. And we went almost a week in advance to plan the whole thing. And I actually was kind of in charge of the motorcade, which was pretty wild in terms of like the logistics of renting the vans and finding volunteer drivers for the non-Secret Service part of it. It was a pretty interesting and pretty wild experience.
Did you clerk right out of law school?
I did. Yeah, I went down to San Antonio, Texas. I'd never been to Texas before in my life. And I clerked for Judge Ed Prado of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. What a great experience. Judge Prado is one of the smartest and also one of the funniest people I've ever met. And it was initially supposed to be just a one-year clerkship. And a couple weeks in, he asked me if I wanted to extend to a second year, which was great and just a really wonderful experience, and got to see the insides of how judicial decisions are made.
How was that circuit back then politically? And tell me a little about what you learned during those 2 years.
It was pretty conservative then, although it's become even much more conservative now. But it certainly had a conservative tilt. Judge Prado, he would say he liked to be seen as a chameleon in that he was pretty moderate. He could go kind of on either side. You know, his vote was never guaranteed for one side or the other, which was great, right? Which is sort of what you want judges to be like. You want them to consider each case on their merits and not have preconceived notions about how they're going to rule. I will say that we got to know all of the other judges on the court pretty well and what their viewpoints were. And we could predict pretty accurately how Judge Jones, Edith Jones, would rule on a case involving police. I mean, it was just pretty obvious. Or we could know pretty clearly how Judge Dennis might rule on a similar case. What I learned is that a lot of legal writing that is submitted is actually not that strong. It's sort of depressing to see that the good lawyers really stand out, because there's a lot of lawyers who, you know, as the law clerks, we were trying to essentially make the case for them when their briefs were lacking. Just because someone doesn't have as strong of a lawyer doesn't mean that they shouldn't have the best shot, or the client shouldn't have the best shot at winning a case. So we would do a lot of research to fill in the gaps often of sometimes when the briefs weren't as strong. You also learn, don't trust all the briefs. You got to verify everything yourself because you never know the kind of spin. Lawyers aren't outright lying usually, but as zealous advocates for their clients, they're putting a spin on things. And so you needed to dive in and look at the actual information yourself. We had some really hard cases. I worked on some death penalty cases, which were the hardest things that we did. And I learned a lot about how to separate my own personal views on an issue from really following what the law says. And that can lead to results that maybe you don't like personally, but that's the role of a judge. And I think it's an important thing for a young lawyer to learn.
What did you think of the quality of the judges in terms of their ability to reason and come down on fairly on cases?
Generally speaking, I think the judges are really good. At least they were then on the Fifth Circuit. And I have no reason to believe they're not now. Again, except for there are some judges who have strong ideological viewpoints. And so you kind of know where they're going to come down. And, you know, I'm not necessarily saying that the judges are results oriented as much as their approach is predictable or was predictable. So you kind of had a good sense of what they were likely to rule or how they're likely to rule on a case, not because they say, oh, the police should always win, but their ideological viewpoint and their approach leads to that result. The other thing you learn while clerking is that depending on the judge, the clerks themselves have a pretty strong influence. I remember one case that we were working on, and there was sort of a battle of memos back and forth among several judges on the court internally as the judges were debating the issue. And what I knew actually, though, was that it was essentially a battle of memos between the clerks. The clerk would draft the memo, send it up to the judge they're working for. The judge would review it, send it on to the other judges at the court. It'd go down to that judge's clerks for them to review. And so it was sort of back and forth through the judges. But, you know, the clerks, you know, they weren't running the place, but they certainly had a pretty big influence, which I think is really interesting.
Were any of the cases that came through in those 2 years voting rights related?
We only had one case that I worked on directly that was a voting rights. I mean, it was also kind of half voting rights, half procedural in terms of the way in which the case was going through the judicial system. So it would have been great if I had a chance to work on more voting rights cases there. I didn't. We did have some fascinating cases I worked on. I got to work on the Jeff Skilling case. Jeff Skilling was the CEO of Enron, who was charged with multiple crimes. The case went up to the U.S. Supreme Court. Our decision was affirmed in part and reversed in part. And my judge likes to say that he got affirmed, but the clerks got reversed for the bars that we worked on. I worked on a case involving a Texas statute that banned the distribution of so-called obscene devices. This was essentially a sex toy case. Texas had a law that banned the distribution of sex toys, trying to kind of close down adult shops. And the court struck down that law under the Constitution. And that was a really interesting case to work on, just in terms of the various First Amendment implications and the privacy implications of a Texas law that was trying to regulate obscene devices.
It seems like you worked briefly for a private law firm and then became a law professor. Tell me about what happened there. What was it like in the firm? Why did you leave and why do what you do?
So I joined the firm Akin Gump after my clerkship in San Antonio, but I kind of always had my eye on academia. It was a good move to make in terms of getting some actual experience as a lawyer that was separate from being with the judge, separate from clerking. And financially, it helped certainly. I had a lot of loans coming out of law school, and law firms pay well. But I never thought it was a long-term thing for me. I didn't expect it to be as short as it was. So I joined the firm, expecting to be there a couple of years, but also decided to try my hand on the academic market around that same time because everyone told me that it would take a couple tries, that it was good to go through the process of being on the market for law professors. And that whole process is pretty convoluted. And so people said, you know, try it out once, get a sense of the sorts of things that it entails. And then I just got lucky and managed to land a position at a law school on my first try. I was happy and fortunate, but somewhat unexpected in terms of the plan was to be at the firm longer. It was really interesting, you know, when I went to tell my law firm's partner that I was going to be leaving, I said, look, you know, I understand that this is a lot shorter than I had even expected. And one interesting kind of story that I like to tell my students about this. So when I began at the law firm, I got a pretty nice signing bonus because I had been a law clerk, and the firms typically give a decent signing bonus, and I used that money to pay off my law school loans. But part of the agreement for that signing bonus was that I would be there for a year, and or I'd have to pay back a prorated amount. So I went to the law firm's partner and I said, look, I've got some news, and I didn't really expect this, but I'm going to be leaving to become a law professor. And I said, but I know there's this bonus situation out there that I'd be expected to pay back some of it if there's some way I could do some freelance work after I've left or some other way to make it up. And he said, well, let me go talk to some people and I'll get back to you. And he comes back to my office about an hour or two later and he said, I've got good news and I've got bad news. I said, okay. He said, the bad news is you owe me a drink. I said, okay. He said, the good news is don't worry about the bonus and don't worry about paying anything back. And I was so fortunate and grateful for him. And basically what he told me is, look, you've done great work here. You've been dedicated. And in fact, there was a person who started at the same time as me who left a couple months before I did, and they made her pay her bonus back. And he said to me, like, look, as compared to her, you did really great work. You're dedicated. You're not leaving for a competitor firm. You're leaving for academia. And I tell my students, it's a good lesson of always do good work, because you never know how the result of what that might mean for you. And so I had a very good experience. I have nothing bad to say about the firm. I worked on some interesting cases. I got to do some pro bono work. They treated me really well. I joke for a cup of coffee that I was there, but I gained a lot out of it.
I mean, it's really wise in general not to burn bridges in the world too. And I don't know, but I would guess that like you've had interaction down the road with people that you do there and that you left on good terms, benefited them and benefited you. I mean, that's just wise.
And honesty is really important, right? I was nervous going in to tell him because, it was unexpected from their perspective, at least for it to happen that soon. And I told him I would be dedicated to working for the next several, I think I gave about 2 months notice, and I was very dedicated to working, hard there. I think people respect good work and respect honesty, and they understand life brings different situations. If you deceive people, they're going to remember that a lot more than if you treat them well. And I think that's really true.
It seems like, just from reading about you a bit and seeing what you've been up to, that you made the right decision, that you seem to like being a law professor, that you're doing a lot of things, both academically, writing books for public consumption and for more academic consumption, writing editorials, you have a podcast. It seems like it must be a good fit for you. Is it?
Oh, I love it. Yeah, there's no better job. I love being in the classroom. The students are engaging. They're interesting. I love first-year law students because they're impressionable. They're eager. And they haven't been jaded yet, unfortunately. Some of the upper-level students get a little bit jaded as they're going through law school. But even my upper-level students, because I get to teach election law and constitutional law, we're grappling with really difficult issues, often with no right answer. The classroom aspect is really interesting. And then, as you mentioned, I have a lot of autonomy and flexibility to work on things that I find interesting. And I try to, I don't know about do it all, but I have a very strong interest in the core scholarly work of writing law review articles, which is kind of the tool of the trade for law professors. I found a niche in looking at state constitutions and voting rights, something that not a lot of other people are considering, but I think is really important as you see the U.S. Supreme Court cut back on voting rights. I've written, as you mentioned, a couple books, and I really like that public engagement that I get. I'll do bookstore talks after the book comes out, and it's really interesting to talk to people who just care about democracy but aren't lawyers who want to engage in these topics. And as you said, I've written a lot of op-eds for various media publications. In college, I thought maybe journalism could have been a path for me. I talked to a lot of people and I wanted to be a professional writer and make a good living while doing it. And journalists is a great profession, but I think harder in many ways. So the op-eds kind of let me be a pseudo-journalist without working for a media publication and getting to do it as someone who has studied these issues.
Do you ever practice as a lawyer? Do you get involved in voting rights cases or just study them?
Not usually. I've done a couple of amicus briefs, amicus often referred to as friend of the court briefs, in various cases. I've done expert work in a couple of cases, but I try to approach those in a very nonpartisan way. That's one of the things that I've really tried to focus on, is ensuring a nonpartisan voice instead of being hired by one side or the other. So I get requests pretty regularly to do candidate work, and I always turn them down. I don't want to be seen as someone who is working for a particular political party or a particular candidate, and there are strategic reasons for that, which we can go into if you want. So I try to be very careful in the actual work I'm doing. And you know, I'm licensed as a lawyer in Texas, but my bar license is inactive purposefully. I could turn it on by just paying the Texas bar or whatever the fees would be to go to active status. I've chosen not to because I'm not taking on clients. I'm not working on cases beyond being an expert or writing an amicus brief. I think that has helped me in many ways. I'm not doing candidate client work.
People who study the history of voting rights in this country know that it has been a pretty up and down road. Obviously, more people have been allowed to vote through the Constitution over time, but almost any advance has been followed by pushback and then kind of an iteration between Congress maybe stepping in and pushing back against things that have happened in the courts. It's a complicated and crazy history. During the time that you've been a professor, there's been a lot of moves there. Can you talk a little bit about how we've got to this moment? I mean, you have a whole book coming about it. Tell us the story a little bit about our situation with voting rights in this country, which is much more complicated than the layperson would know.
Yeah, it is extremely complicated and extremely tumultuous in terms of the history. Of course, at the founding, voting rights was very much restricted to white male property owners. So if you look at that compared to today, obviously, it's a much more inclusive environment. That said, there's been kind of fits and starts. It's push and pull. You know, some expansions here, and then there's pullbacks to it. A lot of people don't realize that the U.S. Constitution does not explicitly grant the right to vote. When you ask people, what are the most important rights within the Constitution? They'll typically say things like free speech. They might say something like privacy, and they'll often say the right to vote. But the right to vote is not actually explicitly protected. It's required judicial interpretation of the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause as recognizing a federal constitutional right to vote, which also means that the courts can be very stingy with respect to its protection of voting rights. You know, the book that's coming out looks at 9 cases from the Supreme Court that have really undermined the protection of the right to vote. And many people think that it all started with Bush v. Gore in 2000, or maybe Shelby County, the case about the Voting Rights Act, the gutted the Voting Rights Act in 2013, or they might point to the Citizens United case about campaign finance in 2010. One thing I show in the book is that all of those cases have as a foundation some other cases that people haven't heard of from the 1970s, 1980s, and 1990s. It's a kind of recent history. It's a 5-decade look back, but it's not just about Bush v. Gore or Shelby County on the Voting Rights Act. It's really about these cases that people weren't paying attention to in the 80s and 90s that laid the foundation for the current conservative court to claim they're adhering to precedent, but really gut the protection for voting rights. But I'm an optimist in nature. And so the other thing I like to point out and look at is the ways in which grassroots movements can expand voting rights. And this isn't a new thing. If you look at the women's suffrage movement, that started through grassroots advocacy and through initially local laws that let women vote in school board or local elections, and then state laws in places like Wyoming, to then finally reach a tipping point where we had the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution that enfranchised women in all elections. So it's a very complicated story, more complicated than most people realize.
One of the threads of that complication is the sort of voting rights, 15th Amendment, Voting Rights Act, and then Section 2 and 5, and how much they were backed or pushed back by the courts. Can you talk a little bit about that thread?
Yeah, and of course, you can't talk about the history of the right to vote or today's current struggles with voting rights without discussing minority voting rights, right? Voting rights for Black and Brown individuals and the progress, but then the pushback against it. Of course, individuals, people of color, were not allowed to vote formally until the 15th Amendment, although actually there was some in a couple places early on in the founding, but really the 15th Amendment, which says that you can't deny the right to vote on the basis of race. But of course, through Reconstruction and Jim Crow, that was not effectuated at all. And individuals, certainly, you know, after Reconstruction and during Jim Crow era, were not allowed to vote. And really, you didn't have a push for minority voting rights until the Voting Rights Act of 1965. So that law, one of the most important civil rights laws ever, was a huge change in the ability of people of color to register and to participate in the political process. And you mentioned both Section 2 and Section 5 of that law. Section 2 applies nationwide, and it says you can't have any voting rules that have the intent or the effect of making it more difficult for people to vote on account of their race. Section 5, which is what the court essentially gutted in the Shelby County case in 2013, which said certain jurisdictions, those with a history of discrimination in voting, had to seek pre-approval for their voting laws before they could put them into effect. But what you saw is attacks from 1965 on. There were lawsuits every time Congress reauthorized the Voting Rights Act and the Section 5 requiring certain jurisdictions, mostly in the South, though not entirely, but mostly in the South, to seek pre-approval. There was a lawsuit. And every single time the Supreme Court rejected the lawsuit and said, no, this is a measure that Congress recognized needs to be in place to protect minority voters, until 2013, when the court agreed with the plaintiffs and struck down the coverage formula for the act, that is, the formula to determine which jurisdictions had to seek pre-approval, and that essentially gutted the Section 5 mechanism.
Your book refers to this history as troublesome. That seems to be your editorial thought about it. Why is this troublesome?
Well, and troublesome may be too mild, actually, but it is a good description, because most people think of the court as a protector of rights, even though in recent years, I think people have recognized that the court has, you know, become very conservative and has underprotected rights. You can look at the Dobbs case with abortion. You can look at gun rights, which is protecting rights, but in perhaps in a way that seems not as faithful to the history of the Second Amendment. But I think generally speaking, if you look at the three branches of government, at least in terms of people's trust, the court still comes out on top, even though people's trust in the court has gone down. People still say they trust the courts more than the presidency and certainly more than Congress. The book is telling a story about that trust with respect to voting rights and really saying, look, that trust is totally misplaced. And again, it's not a recent phenomenon, right? It's not that the court just recently has turned to challenging voting rights and not protecting voting rights. This has been something that's been going on for 50 years. If we actually have a democracy where every person's vote matters, then we need a court system that will protect that against the political actors who are trying to gain a political advantage by taking away people's right to vote or by trying to shape the electorate how they want, whether it's through gerrymandering, whether it's through cutbacks on voting opportunities, whether it's through voter ID laws that they know certain constituencies will have a harder time complying with. It's really about how the court has been an important actor in underprotecting voting rights in a way that I think maybe most people will not recognize or don't appreciate and think, well, it's just happened since Shelby County. No, it's been happening for 50 years. And that's really why we have the struggles in democracy that we do have today.
A bunch of the things that you mentioned, like gerrymandering, but also money in politics, like Citizens United, you also brought up, have the more of an effect of like vote dilution. like somebody's different people's votes not being equal because of the way things were laid out. And some of that is pretty intentional and goes back to the beginning. Do you think that we have the right constitutional structure to protect people's rights? Should we have an amendment to the Constitution that said something like there is a constitutional right to vote and it can't be undermined? Or can we just trust judges to interpret things in a strong way?
Well, so I'll say two things that maybe are a little bit contradictory. I think that the structure of the Constitution would allow the protection of the right to vote that we need. And we saw that in the 1960s when the Warren Court did issue a bunch of rulings that were much more protective of voting rights. And then again, in the 70s and 80s, you saw that pullback. So I think the structure is there, but I don't think today's court or a court of the near future is going to use that structure because of the court's approach. So I think that, yes, a constitutional amendment that explicitly recognizes the right to vote would be useful. Certainly a constitutional amendment that does away with the Electoral College for electing the president is needed. The other thing I'd say is that state constitutions, virtually all of them, do protect the right to vote. This is something I've discussed in my more scholarly work, how 49 of the 50 state constitutions have provisions that explicitly protect the right to vote. And what you see in the state courts is that some judges are doing a good job in invoking those state constitutional clauses and more robustly protecting voting rights. Other judges, however, have not read those state constitutions correctly in a way that shows that they're broader and more protective than the U.S. Constitution. What some state judges do is say, well, yeah, we had the state constitution protecting voting rights, but we're just going to follow what the U.S. Supreme Court does because the U.S. Supreme Court has also considered issues of voting rights. So we're going to follow what they do. It's a doctrine known as lockstepping. They're going to lockstep their state constitution with the federal constitution. I think that's wrong. And so, you know, the tools are there in state courts under state constitutions for judges that are willing to use them. But having a U.S. constitutional amendment that also more explicitly protects the right to vote perhaps would free up state courts in more robustly protecting voting rights as well, at least those state courts that have been unwilling to do so.
I think it'd be impossible to discuss voting rights and elections right now without bringing up what happened after the 2020 election, with Trump leading into it saying he wouldn't necessarily, and then instigating an insurrection and continuing to claim that he won when he didn't. As a law professor doing this, trying to be nonpartisan, how are you handling that? How did you view this episode in our history, which is ongoing?
Yeah, I opened the new book with the story of me watching it. You know, I said I couldn't believe my eyes. What's interesting for me is that January 6th was marked on my calendar as a day to pay attention to what's going on well before other people were talking about January 6th because I'm an election geek, right? I study this stuff. And so I knew that that's an important part of the presidential election. But thankfully, most people have never paid attention on January 6th because it's just so routine. I think there is a difference between being partisan and being pro-democracy. As I tell my students, I'm not going to sugarcoat what Trump did in terms of undermining democracy, and that's not a partisan, at least it shouldn't be a partisan issue, just like writing about the protection of voting rights and saying, look, I want everyone who's eligible to be able to vote in a democracy should not be a partisan issue. It's about protecting the right to vote for all Americans. Yes, I'm sure I'll have students who are Trump supporters who think what Trump did was fine, but honestly, that's not pro-democracy. Trump was not and did not want to operate in a system in which the losers gracefully accept defeat and go on to fight the next battle. He tried to undermine leading up to the election, right? He told us what he would do. He said, I'm not going to accept the results unless I win. Well, he didn't win. And what did he do? He didn't accept the results. And then he rallied millions of his supporters. And to this day, you still see a huge segment of the Republican Party in particular that are election deniers that think that Trump won the 2020 election. It's all based on lies. I do think we need to make a distinction between, you know, saying and advocating for something that is partisan and advocating for being pro-democracy, regardless of whichever side wins. There are Republicans who've been running for president who are pro-democracy. Trump has not been one of them.
You're teaching in Kentucky. That's a pretty Republican state across the breadth of it, maybe not in the cities. Do you get blowback? How do your students react to this position that you're taking, which ought not be controversial, clearly, but is in the electorate?
Yeah, I certainly have some students who are strong Trump supporters. I have many students who are strong Republicans who aren't necessarily Trump apologists, but are going to toe the party line, and that's fine. My question is, can we engage in a reasonable debate based on actual facts? And I have to say that the students I have in the law school, I've not seen many of them at least being vocally pro-Trump in a way that is contrary to facts. I can totally accept the idea that, you know, I'm going to hold my nose and support Trump, even though I think everything he's doing is wrong for democracy, because I prefer one team and the things I'm going to get from that team winning are good. We have to consider the way in which it is undermining the very core of democracy. But I have not had a lot of students who are actual election deniers, or at least they have not been vocal about that to me. In fact, many of my most conservative students have agreed or accepted that the facts aren't there with respect to the 2020 election. And so I think that is promising, at least. The debates we're having are reasonable.
When you're writing this book, who are you imagining as the audience? Like, what sort of reader, and what would you want people to take from it?
So my ideal reader is the engaged non-lawyer who knows there's been something up about the Supreme Court, but doesn't fully understand what it is. Who knows they've heard of the cases of Citizens United, but don't truly understand what the court actually said and why it is a problem. I approach Citizens United in the book as a voting rights case. Most people think of it as a case about money in politics, and it is, but I also think it's about the right to vote. And so I discuss the way in which it's also a voting rights case. I think of the members of the League of Women Voters. They were such great supporters of my first book, and I had many events around the country where local league chapters came to my book events, and we're sort of doing that again for this book. Members of the League of Women Voters are engaged, typically non-lawyers, so they understand the perils of democracy, but perhaps not the details and not the true reasons behind what the court has done. And so this book is hopefully going to educate individuals like that. Yeah, I've heard of some of these cases, not all. I've heard of, what did the court actually say in Bush v. Gore? Most people think Bush v. Gore is a 5-4 decision on the court on ideological lines. Actually, the most important holding was 7-2, and most people don't realize that. And so I talk about that. So it's really, the hope is to educate people who care about democracy.
You mentioned the first book, Vote For Us.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it was aimed at a slightly different audience. What were you doing in that, and who should look at that particular one?
So I think it's actually the same audience, but it's a little bit of a different approach. So Vote For Us is really a book about the good news in voting rights. And I tell people I wrote a book about good news in voting rights, and they sort of chuckle and say, well, that can't be. It's just a page long. There's no such thing as good news in voting rights. And it's, actually an entire book about individuals on the ground in communities all over the country. I refer to them as democracy champions who are working to improve the voting process through local reforms. So I have a chapter on ranked choice voting. I have a chapter on public financing for local campaigns and the democracy voucher model in Seattle, where voters receive vouchers that they can then give to candidates who have opted in for public financing. I have a chapter on reforms for voters with disabilities and making it easier for individuals to participate. Got a chapter on expanded voter registration, again, which started at the local level or the state level first. We talk about vote by mail, and this was before the pandemic, but how vote by mail had started to expand. So it's really telling the individual stories of people who have worked to enhance voting rights in their communities, and then how those stories have spread. So it's sort of the anti-doom and gloom in voting rights. So anyone who's looking for hope, I think, would be inspired by the possibility. And one of the things that I was very careful about in that book is that I only discussed reforms that are actually working and have been implemented somewhere in the country so that people can read it and say, oh, well, it's worked there. Maybe we can incorporate it here. So in many ways, the two books kind of go hand in hand, although perhaps they were in the wrong order. The first book is the good news, and the second book is, well, some bad news, at least about how the Supreme Court has underprotected voting rights.
Definitely an overlap in our interests, and I've interviewed on this podcast a lot of leaders of groups that have worked on democracy vouchers or worked in the ranked choice vote movement, or certainly tons of people working on changing registration laws or getting more people registered and things like that. So pretty interesting. I know you also have started a podcast, and democracy optimists seemed like enough of a difference from the feeling in the air lately to be pretty intriguing. I listened to the first episode. Tell me a little bit about what your thinking was there about that kind of platform. That seems like another way for you to express yourself and listen to people who are at work in this area.
Yeah. So Democracy Optimist, the title of the podcast and radio program, is very intentional and very purposeful. Some people have said it describes me, but also is an aspirational goal, right? So I think there are a lot of things to be concerned about. And yet, if we aren't optimistic at the same time, then things are just only going to get worse, right? We could either throw up our hands and say the system is rigged and we can't fix it, or we can double down in our efforts to enhance democracy and voting rights. So on the podcast, I interview people who are engaged in elections. Part of the goal is just to explain to everyday listeners, how do elections actually operate? So the first two episodes, I interviewed secretaries of state, Michael Adams, a Republican from my state of Kentucky, and Jocelyn Benson, a Democrat from Michigan, to just simply have them explain and engage in a myth-busting enterprise, because so many people are confused about how elections operate or believe the wrong things. So I'm trying to interview people who are actively engaged in the voting process. I also ask them, at least most of the interviews, I ask two questions. One, are you optimistic about voting in elections given all the doom and gloom? And honestly, virtually everyone I've interviewed so far has said they are optimistic in spite of the challenges. And I ask them, why should people vote? Right? What's the point of voting? And the answers have been very inspiring, and people really believe in this enterprise of democracy. I have segments on the podcast about kind of the election highlight of the day, interesting election facts, all in the goal of educating people about how this thing actually works. The old cliche of knowledge is power, I think, is really true. And that's the hope of the show.
The upcoming election, which has a decent chance of being won by Trump and a decent chance actually of the Republicans controlling Congress, time will tell, has the potential to have a president who appoints a lot more judges that are not strong on voting rights, and a Congress very far from making some of the needed reforms that we've talked about or the other people are talking about, is more likely to go the other way. If that happens, do you think you continue with your optimism post-election?
So I think I'd have guarded optimism, depending on, you know, what the president and Congress did, but also what the response would be. I still think there's a role for grassroots movements. I think there's a role for local and state voting laws. And one of the things I talk about in the new book at the end is, because we can't trust the Supreme Court, we should find ways to avoid the Supreme Court, which actually means that we should fight for additional bipartisan solutions to some of these issues. I firmly believe that neither side should run the rules of the game. I think it's unfair for Republicans to unilaterally decide how elections should operate. And the same thing, I don't think Democrats should unilaterally decide how elections operate. I teach at the University of Kentucky, a big basketball school. The big rival in basketball is University of Louisville, or one of the big rivals, or maybe Duke is another big rival. And imagine that you had a Final Four game in men's basketball between Kentucky and Duke, and Duke got to decide who the referees were and that they're all going to be huge Duke fans. Only people who think that's fair maybe are the diehard Dukies. Kentucky fans and most other people would view that as unfair. I think that's the same with voting rights. This really requires us to double down a commitment to finding bipartisan solutions, something that we've actually done in Kentucky to some success. And you know what? We avoided lawsuits on some of these new laws, which had the dual goals of improving election security and enhancing the ability of people to vote. That's how things should be done.
One of the very interesting things going on at the Supreme Court right now is their decision to hear the presidential immunity question, which clearly affects an attempt to hold Trump accountable for what happened post-2020. What do you think of them taking that case? What do you think we should think about the possible outcomes of that? And how does that fit in your mind, to the rule of law and voting in this country at this time?
I was really disappointed that the court agreed to take the case and set it for oral argument in the end of April, as opposed to sending it back to the trial court for the trial, you know, the criminal trial to begin. I sort of thought that a compromise situation was brewing at the court where they would reject the challenges to his eligibility to be on the ballot in the Colorado case and the other places that have taken him off, but allow the trial to proceed this summer. So that way voters had the most information, right? Voters would know if he is convicted. I wrote a column for CNN that basically argued for that exact thing to happen, that the court should reject the appeal of the immunity case so that the trial could happen this summer. There's a very small possibility that the court could still act quickly and a trial could happen, although, you know, agreeing to hear the case at the end of April makes that likelihood much, much smaller. This tells the story once again about how the court is not on the side of voters. If the court were on the side of voters, it would let voters have the information they need to make an accurate and informed decision. I fear that Trump's strategy of running out the clock perhaps is going to be successful, at least on the criminal case, because I think it's hard to see how the court can hold a trial, you know, in the fall during the height of the presidential election campaign. If nothing else, we're in for quite a crazy year, an unprecedented year where you can't really predict how these things are going to come down.
Is there anything that stands in the way, if he becomes president, of him dispensing with all federal cases against him?
Not really, no. I mean, I think if he becomes president, he can direct the Department of Justice to close all of the inquiries. Now, the state court cases could still proceed, right? So the New York case is already underway. The Georgia case, we'll see what happens with that. But certainly the state court cases can proceed. But there's really nothing in federal law that would stop the president from ending the federal prosecutions.
Is there any chance that this court could confer total immunity on the president to do anything criminal?
I think it's really unlikely, again, which is why I was surprised that the court set argument. The other thing to note, by the way, is it took 2 weeks between when the court said all the filings were due on whether to take the immunity case and when it issued an order saying that it would set the case for oral argument. There was obviously internal discussions going on. I just have to assume that the long delay here, that's a long time just to decide, yeah, we're going to take a case and set it for argument a month later, or actually 2 months later, a little under 2 months later. I have to believe that there was some pretty vigorous internal conversations going on at the court between the justices on this issue. But the DC Circuit opinion on the immunity case was so thorough and so strong. I would just be really surprised if a majority of the court would reject its analysis, because it's sort of crazy. I mean, Trump's lawyer was asked at the oral argument in the DC Circuit. So if the president ordered a hit, an assassination on another foreign leader, he would be immune from prosecution. That can't be right. I mean, that just can't be right under the law. And I don't think a majority of the justices would agree with that position.
I can't imagine that they'd want Joe Biden to take out Trump before the election.
It just can't be right. The delay is frustrating because I think most legal observers believe that the court will not grant the immunity in such the broad way that Trump is asking. And yet the delay makes it much harder to have the trial before the election.
Do you read that as them cooperating in the delay tactic, or do you read that as them wanting to put their fingerprints on the rules?
I read it as four justices, because it just takes four justices to grant certiorari and set a case for argument. I read it as four justices wanting to have the final say on the issue, as opposed to letting the DC Circuit have the final say.
What should I have asked you that I failed to that is important going on right now?
Great question. What should you have asked that you didn't? Well, we didn't talk about why I try really hard to have a nonpartisan public voice.
A little we did, but it is a very hard time, I think, in your field to maintain that.
Yeah, I think that's right. And so I'll just tell you a little bit about the strategy I've had. And like I said, I've been contacted by campaigns and they're going to pay me a lot of money to work on candidate issues. And I have turned them down. The reason is I think that I can have a credible voice, or at least I hope I can have a credible voice, as someone who's not seen as in the bag for one side or the other. And you mentioned, you know, that I live in Kentucky in a pretty conservative state. I think I'm able to be, quote, in the room where it happens more easily because neither side really sees me as trying to be a partisan operative. People read my work and they make assumptions about which side I support, and that's fine. But at the same time, I think people can trust me to provide an honest voice that is not one that's trying to help one side or the other win. So it's a strategic choice I've made. I think it's partially because I'm in Kentucky and I hope to have some influence in the state here. But you're right, everything seems so partisan when simply letting people vote is seen as a partisan mechanism, or heck, democracy is seen as something that's partisan. I reject that premise. I think we need to fight back against that notion that simply supporting democracy itself is pro-democratic party. It isn't and it shouldn't be. The other thing I think we need to do is really lift up the voices of Republicans who are pro-democracy. My personal view is that Democrats in Illinois were short-sighted in, for example, gerrymandering Adam Kinzinger out of a congressional seat in Illinois. If you're the Democrats, you should want someone like Kinzinger in Congress, someone who is against you politically, but it believes in democracy. And I think that Democrats in particular need to be better at lifting up pro-democracy Republicans.
It's a tricky call sometimes on these democracy issues. Like, some people would argue that trying to keep Trump off the ballot based on what he did insurrection-wise, like they're doing in Colorado or Illinois, is pro-democracy because you're trying to keep an anti-democracy candidate off the ballot for valid reasons. And other people would say invalidating a candidacy of someone who's followed by many millions of people is anti-democratic. What's the right call there?
It's a really hard question, right? Because you're sort of asking about, does that constitutional clause mean anything? Or are we going to ignore it just because so many people support him? My own view is that if the Constitution means something, then the evidence seems pretty clear that he engaged in insurrection and should be therefore ineligible. Otherwise, you're making the Constitution, that particular phrase, meaningless for one person. I totally understand, however, the push to say that, look, it's more pro-democracy for the voters to reject him at the ballot box if that's what they want to do. That's why this stay of the immunity case, right? That's why this delay in the criminal trial is so frustrating. I can accept a compromise where you let him on the ballot but give voters all the information. It's hard to say that we're going to essentially ignore a constitutional clause about making someone ineligible who engaged in insurrection if you're also not going to give voters all the information they need to make a valid choice.
It didn't seem like the Supreme Court, from the reporting on the oral arguments, gave real credence to the argument that Trump should be disqualified. And in fact, the reasoning from the justices that spoke seemed almost like they didn't grasp the situation to me.
Yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of it was technical, and we'll see if the decision has come down before our episode airs. But my prediction is that the court's going to say it's up to Congress to declare someone ineligible, that the 14th Amendment Section 3 exists, but only, you know, Congress is the right entity to make that decision. So I sort of think that's likely where the court's going to come down, but it requires some legal gymnastics to reach that result. That is unfortunate.
And they are not opposed to showing their gymnastic skills.
That's right.
Well, it's been great to talk to you, Josh. Anything else you want to say?
Just thanks for having me on. It's always good to be able to discuss these important issues of democracy. So I really appreciate it.
Thanks. That was Josh Douglas. He is at joshuaadouglas.com. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at greatbattlefield.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found. The Great Battlefield is now part of the Democracy Group Podcast Network. Visit democracygroup.org to learn more about other podcasts that cover democracy and civic engagement. You can also help me by leaving comments and good ratings on Apple Podcasts or elsewhere, and by sending me suggestions for great guests to nperlman@gmail.com.